Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Poultry and egg farming has been a sensitive topic in Canada and pretty much everywhere else in the industrialized world since long before activists decided to start taking unauthorized self-guided tours of poultry barns. The food, retail, and dining sectors are mindful about customer concerns as to how birds are housed and cared for, and of course, producer groups are responding. But with changes to how birds go about their day, we're seeing a whole different laundry list of bird health and welfare concerns. On the other end of the line right now is Jennifer Glennie. She's a reporter with our Ontario Ag Journal, Farmtario. Jennifer, hi, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Dave. Happy to be here. How are you today?
I am well. Now, a little while back, you went to the Poultry Innovations Conference in London, and these new disease risks were a topic of discussion there. Free-run barns are nothing new for some sectors of the poultry industry, but for others, adopting new systems is a bit of a steeper learning curve?
Yes. So layer chickens and layer barns are having changes made to their federal code of practice. So as of April 2017, battery cages, which are the classic cages, are no longer allowed to be included in new barn builds. And all existing battery cages must be phased out of all the barns by 2036. So farmers are required to either convert to enriched housing, which would be enriched cages, and these include perches and nests, and there'd be less birds per cage, or they have to go cage-free, which is the run of the whole barn.
Mm-hmm. Now, ostensibly, this is great for the birds. They get opportunities to move around and roam and flap and perch and peck and whatnot. You know, every time I look out a window, I see birds perching, and it looks like the most natural behavior ever. And now here's your article in Farmtario telling us that this, in some ways, can be a health risk.
Yes. So perches, as you said, they're a big factor, and they're a big factor in the new enriched housing. So that is the cage system, the enriched cages. But they can create bumblefoot, which is a bacterial infection in the bird's foot. So if the perches are not clean and dry, the bird's feet become damp as they're standing on them for long periods of time, creating an infection, bumblefoot. Mm-hmm. And also if the perches are too small, the claws can actually come around and dig into the palm, creating an open wound, and then this can be a major issue, obviously, for bumblefoot, allowing infection to enter.
Mm-hmm. Now, full disclosure time, we had a few chickens and turkeys when I was a kid, but my folks were mostly in grain and hogs, not in production poultry or anything. You know, all I knew is there was a guy who used to play guitar for Guns N' Roses named Bumblefoot, and my understanding, his wife was studying vet health, and he took the nickname from the bacterial infection. Now, if I understand it correctly, Bumblefoot, it's sort of like bed sores, but except on bird feet. Am I correct?
So what happens is, they almost get like a buildup within their feet, and that's the infection, and that can actually be removed. But obviously on like a commercial size operation, that's just not realistic.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do producers who've never dealt with it have to know now?
So if you're dealing with the perches, they need to be clean, dry, and of proper width. So bumblefoot is a difficult infection, as I just mentioned. So it can be treated, as I said, with the removal of the infection, but just for the size of the laying operations, it's just not realistic.
Yeah.
So where their feet are, whether on the perches or on the floor of the barn, it needs to be dry and clean because the dampness is what is the greatest cause for the infection.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of which, let's talk about the sort of the shared roaming areas that birds have in these barns for a minute. What kind of surface are these birds going to be wandering around on?
So there actually are barns that will use minimal or no bedding, which is okay. Like it's a perfectly good substrate for the birds to be walking on. But the producers have to understand that the flock is walking, eating, and dust baiting in manure when this can obviously be a major concern.
Ugh. So now if you've got even one sick bird, then I guess all the other birds that are sort of tracking through its droppings could be up for the same illnesses. You know, how can producers manage for this?
Yeah, so manure management, it's huge. And it's important to ensure that it's at the proper moisture. So too dry of manure can cause respiratory issues, as dust can carry Celia and E. coli. But if it's too wet, the bedding can create ammonia and, again, bumblefoot. But there was actually a study completed in Turkey that found that wet, clean shavings can cause just as much bumblefoot as manure.
Really?
So this just proves that it's all in the moisture and not so much in the actual substrate use or the bacteria content.
So not too wet, not too dry. That's kind of, it seems like a kind of a fine line to have to walk there, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So some farms will have like a sprinkler system in, and you can manage the dryness by that. But again, if it's too wet, then you can have other issues.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, you've got birds laying eggs in these systems as well. You know, now that a farmer's sort of getting rid of the cages, where is the egg laying happening?
So in the aviary system, so for farmers that choose to have this type of barn, and, you know, freedom to roam the barn, the nests are throughout. So the nest is where they will lay their eggs. And they'll lay in a nest where they feel comfortable and that the nest is appeasing to them. So it's clean, it's dry, and it's of easy access.
Mm-hmm. So now what have producers got to do in these systems to make sure that the eggs are being laid where they're supposed to?
Yeah, so 90 to 95% of eggs are laid in nests.
Yes.
So birds really want to lay their eggs in a nest. They actually say that a bird will work harder to lay in a nest than they will to find proper feed. So for the birds not to be laid in a, for the birds not to lay in a nest, there must be something quite aversive about that nest for that not to happen. So the nest could be wet, it could be dirty, might not be of easy access. So it's important for the producers to understand the cause of why their birds are not laying in a nest, if that is an issue. What those issues are for the birds, like what they're facing, and for them to allow the birds full access to all nests. So basically find out what the issue is, fix it, and then allow the birds to have access to all nests to ensure that 90 to 95% of eggs are laid within nests.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a lot that producers have to look forward to over the next few years. Jennifer Glennie, thank you very much for coming on the show, and thanks very much for sharing this with us.
Oh, no, thank you, Dave.
Jennifer Glennie is a reporter with FarmTerio. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. There's no shortage of tech and tools to help farmers collect and collate data these days, but with data, as with farming, it's up to the farmer to sort the chaff from the grain and the keepers from the culls. And once we have that, how does a farmer use it to really make change in his or her operations? Greg Berg is our online editor with Glacier Farm Media. He paid a visit last week to Manitoba Ag Days in Brandon and caught up with farmer Eric McLean of the Manitoba Seed Growers Association. He spoke on a producer panel about gathering and using farm data. Now, where we step into their conversation here, Mr. McLean tells us what sets of data he collects and what data should farmers consider collecting and why.
As a farmer, some of the more important data points that I collect on our farm are included in the basic set of parameters that the equipment can collect, which is yield and moisture, but more specifically what they allow us as building blocks to be able to set up our mapping and our prescriptions for later down the road. And so for me, that's what they are. They aren't really so much that they're important data sets in terms of what the numbers represent, but what they lead us to down the road. So they allow us to interpret that that's a field part of the field that's really higher producing or not. And that allows us to be able to figure out where we should go with our nutrient application and applications further down the road. So when we look at the financial interaction between big data sets and field agronomy, the one thing that we have to look at is the return on investment that we're getting per acre on what we're farming with, and really being brutally honest with the idea of whether or not acres pay and where acres don't. And in farming, a lot of the time we tend to blanket over applications and say, you know, it's just easier just to go over the whole field and not. And really the biggest thing we draw attention to in times when things get skinny is that we need to factor for what parts of the field are producing and which aren't. If we tie that back, you know, economically back to return on investment, then we can really focus on what we're going to make money. And then that's going to peel away some of the layers of the farm that aren't making money and be able to make you more profitable in the end. Those are things that we need, that I as an individual producer am gunning for more so.
That's Eric McLean of the Manitoba Seed Growers Association in conversation with Glacier Farm Media's Greg Berg at Ag Days. Here he tells us what sets of data he'd like to be collecting but can't right now.
The future of on-farm data collection is going to be quite extensive going forward because it's the easiest technology to expand with what we already know on. So it's really going to be a buyer's market in terms of what we're going to want in the near future. But I think he brought up a good point about protein testing, on-demand protein gathering of that. It twigged my curiosity in that one regard. I didn't have a big wish list in terms of what we were gathering before because we're so used to testing for things after the fact. So I mean, I know I'm going to have to bring that home and just really look through things to think about what can we do better with real-time data collection and see where we're headed to.
That's Eric McLean in conversation with Greg Berg of Glacier Farm Media at Ag Days in Brandon. Greg also caught up with another Manitoba farmer, Adam Gurr, who is also an on-farm researcher with AgriTruth Research Incorporated. Here he tells us what data he collects and how he puts it to work on his farm.
Well, we collect all sorts of data. I guess we collect economic data. We collect things related to production, so things that influence production like climate, soil, inputs we've provided or applied and, you know, how they work and stuff like that. And then we collect a lot of really what would be different on our farm would be the scale of the on-farm research component of data collection. And so that really drives where we go with our farm with related to production.
Yeah, I think I saw on one of your slides actually, climate data, soil data, seeding dates, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It seemed like you focus mostly so far on wheat variety trials and that sort of thing. What if you could expand and talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, like with regards to the wheat variety trial or just anything? Like
anything. You start with the wheat and then if you wish to discuss the thing beyond that, feel free.
So we do, anything related to production, we've tested or we're going to test, I guess, wherever we might see an opportunity to make a cut or to invest other dollars. So we've tested not just wheat varieties, but, you know, all varieties in general, the crops that we grow. We test fertility, ways of applying, like placement methods, timing methods for nitrogen, rates, of course. We test some things long-term, like we have long-term trials and we set up one 3 years ago in cover crops, to test this whole idea of whether there's going to be value in cover crops in an annual crop system. That was a question we had. We'd been to a lot of speakers in that, suggesting that there is value in that from a soil health perspective, but we wanted to get a handle on the economic impact of that. We've tested, seed treatments, fungicides. We do a lot of competitive product comparisons within AgriTruth, like we do that. And then we do also new product testing. So we do a lot of companies, hire us to test new products for them to generate data on in a field scale environment, using scientific methods. And yeah.
That kind of led me to a question I was going to ask earlier, I guess. Mm-hmm. How long have you been doing this type of on-farm research?
Yeah, I've always had an interest in agronomy and agronomic research. So from the time I graduated from diploma program in 99, I started testing treatments on the farm. I just wasn't doing it right. I didn't have a good understanding of basic experimental design and why you statistically analyze and randomize and replicate and stuff like that. So as I moved along further along in my educational then I kind of gained that appreciation for why you do those things. So that allowed us to apply a lot more rigor and have a lot more confidence in the testing we were doing. And so initially I would have had questions just on, relating to seeding rates. It might be that industries maybe provided you with a range, like a provincial recommendation in wheat might be 25 to 35 plants per square foot. But if I can invest in 25 and get the same, yield as 35, then that's what I'm going to do. So it's just refining some of those industry recommendations is probably how some of it started. And then just trying to come up with solutions for, I guess it could be data gaps. They're just not data that existed, or at least local data or current data. It might involve updating data, like the phosphate one was, and that was back in the 70s, I think, that peer-reviewed literature that I showed up there. And I suspect that we'll come to the same general conclusion as that, but it just places it in the context of our current cropping system, the yields we're getting, the varieties we're growing, the crops we're growing. And so I see value in that, because it definitely makes it easier for us to make those significant investments in our farm when we have on-farm data to back it up. Yeah.
Kind of touch briefly on something I was going to ask next. Is there a piece of on-farm data you feel Manitoba farmers are overlooking specifically, or?
I think related to the kind of the type of trials we carry out on our farm, I think people underestimate the value in doing that. We've been doing it enough years and we see how it drives change on our farm. And it's a very safe way of doing it. Like if you're just going out there and running a strip trial or unreplicated, or if you're just picking a field here or there, there's so many other variables that could influence those results. And I'm just not interested in you know, adopting something that could potentially even be lowering my yield, right? There's a possibility of doing that with unreplicated field scale trials is coming to a conclusion that's going to end up not only where you adopt something, but it's actually lower your yield in addition to that. And those sorts of things I need to avoid. And I don't see a lot of farmers out there, you know, appreciating that as far as influencing their decisions they make on their farm. We have quite a few AgriTruth subscribers that rely on that data to help guide them with some of these decisions. But I think that, and it's gaining momentum. I mean, provincially, you have the grower groups that are promoting these proper on-farm methods, and they're creating networks, and there's all sorts of things springing up out there. So it's just an evolution. I think it's moving in the right direction, but that would be, I wish I had done it sooner in my farming career.
Just general data collection, so you got it. Kind
of thing. Yeah, like the way we do it, just with the on-farm, like randomized, replicated, and you know that sort of thing. Like it may seem, I think a lot of guys don't do it because they see it as sort of a pain in the butt factor. You know, you're busy at harvest time, and I don't want to weigh these strips off and that. But if you become comfortable with the economics associated with that, that's some time very well spent.
Adam Gurr also has a wish list of three specific things that would potentially make data collection on his operation more efficient.
So right now our data for our on-farm research trials are collected. It's all just drive a harvester down the field, dump it in the scale, record the number and stuff like that. And the reason we don't do it where it's kind of like that passive data collection where you just use your yield maps to analyze the data at the end of the season is that I'm not comfortable in the quality of that. And that's something we've tested in the past where, you know, there's very real opportunity to come up with the opposite conclusion based on whether you're accessing yield monitor data or your scaled data. And it just comes down to the inaccuracy at times of yield monitors. So you could be going down the field one way and dump and it's 5% higher than what your scaled weight was. You come back down the other way and it's 5% lower. You know, that's a 10% difference that didn't actually exist. So that's the danger and that sort of thing. So I would like to see more accurate yield monitors, you know, with the accuracy of a scale. And then if we have like these protein sensors, in order for them to be widely adopted, really they need to be integrated into the manufacturer's platform where you just buy a harvester, the protein sensor's on there just like you would with a yield monitor. And if it's all accurate and working well, then that really allows us to increase the scale and complexity of our research program, because there's a lot of trials we could set up just by prescription. And you can't analyze the data like that from strip trials because it's stuff overlaid over top of each other. So you might have multiple treatments in that mile-long strip or whatever, and you need to analyze that after the fact with a GIS program.
That was Adam Gurr of AgriTruth Research in conversation with Glacier Farm Media online editor Greg Berg at Manitoba Ag Days in Brandon. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Well, a lot has happened in world trade since the last time I hosted the show. The US and China have signed off on a Phase 1 trade deal, which seemed to land with a bit of a thump. But the commodities sector has since reacted in a very bearish way to a new concern, the outbreak of pneumonia-type symptoms we now know to be caused by a novel coronavirus spreading out from Wuhan in China. Bruce Burnett of Markets Farm is here with us for a closer look at the market's reaction. Bruce, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
It's good to be here.
Now, why would the markets react in such a way to something that seems to be outside of market fundamentals?
Well, you have to realize that the overall markets, in other words, the equity markets, the bond markets, are reacting pretty significantly to this outbreak. Mm-hmm. And the concern for those markets is that the GDP, the growth of the economy, especially in China, is going to be harmed by this virus for a number of reasons, but basically because a lot of activities are going to stop for a while as they deal with the problem. So that's impacted other markets. And then when that happens, then it spills over into commodities. Mm-hmm. As you also noted, we've just signed a trade deal between the U.S. and China, and there were expectations that we would see some good purchases of goods. And again, the market's feeling that perhaps that was maybe not going to happen if we had some problems or disruptions with the economy due to the virus outbreak in China.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to put this in perspective for listeners, how have the markets responded lately? It seemed to be on a fairly steep path downward last time I looked yesterday.
Yeah, the two primary markets that have been impacted are the oilseed market and the cattle markets and the hog markets. The animal markets, or the meat markets, in other words, they've been impacted because there was an assumption that we would see a real big uptick in trade with China because of the shortage caused by another virus, the African swine fever. Mm-hmm. So really, the markets are a little bit concerned that that won't happen now. So that's the reason for those markets to drop. In the case of oilseeds, again, the assumption was that we'd see a lot of soybean exports from the U.S. to China coming this year after the agreement was signed. And those really haven't happened yet. So the market's very disappointed in that. And then toss in this, again, hit to GDP in terms of the virus itself causing slowing in the economy. And you had people selling almost indiscriminately. The soy oil market's been down about 12-15%. The canola market's down about 5% from the peaks earlier in January here. So that's been the impact. So it is a major impact in the canola markets and the oilseed markets in general.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other sort of basic market fundamentals that we know them that are still in play, or is it all virus all the time now?
It's all virus all the time, although, again, we're going to see that play out here eventually, until there is new news coming into the marketplace that indicates the disease is maybe more severe or something like this, that's then expected, then we're probably going to see the market stabilize a bit. For agricultural commodities themselves, and again, maybe not as much for the meat markets, but certainly for the staple, fundamental vegetable oil and cereal markets, really an outbreak like this doesn't usually impact the import pattern of the country or the global trade in those commodities as well. So eventually the market's going to come back and take a look at the fundamentals and start to trade back off of those rather than these headline news events of the disease and how many people have died and how many people have been infected globally.
But I guess one last thing, though, is, you know, we don't really know yet. There's no sort of real hard timeline as far as when this will play out. I mean, what's a farmer to do in the meantime?
Well, I think the best advice is to just sit back and wait here. Generally speaking, during the major outbreaks that we've seen in the past, like SARS, like MERS, the other very big global diseases that we've seen happen, the events themselves have played out within a month or so. In other words, it's taken about a month for the market to stabilize and then move back to, I guess you would call it, normal. So I think that's about the only thing that you can do right at the moment. In terms of downside, I don't think that there's too much further downside from this disease unless we were to see an escalation in the severity of it. Right now, this disease appears to be a little bit more virulent. In other words, it gets transmitted a little bit easier than mm-hmm. SARS did, but it's not quite as fatal yet. Again, if we were to see that become more of a concern, then certainly that would probably put further additional downside pressure in the markets. But right now it looks as if this disease will probably play itself out. It will be a month or two, but during that period of time, our markets are going to be very, very volatile.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll certainly be keeping track of that in the daily news and also on marketsfarm.com. Bruce Burnett, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bruce Burnett is Director of Markets and Weather with MarketsFarm.com. That's all we have this week, but we'll be back in another week with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to etr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.